be seen from the street or from the neighbor's homes, which was the idea. Joe crunched through the snow to the garage door and tugged up on the handle with no luck. Then he tried the knob on the back door and confirmed it was locked as well. The house was state property, not Pollock's. Joe could either wait for Casey Scales to come up with a spare set of keys and get them to him, or authorize a local locksmith to get inside, provided there was a locksmith in Saratoga. Both would take time Joe didn't think he had, and involve procedures that could get back to Connor Hanlon, who would rightly question why Joe wanted to poke around inside the house of an ex-state employee rather than investigating the disappearance of Kate Shelford Longdon. Which was a good question, he thought. Almost as good as why he'd been sent to Saratoga in the first place. But Pollock's sudden absence was to Joe as puzzling as Kate's. He had to try and figure it out, he thought, and he could partially justify it because there was the remote but possible chance that the two disappearances were somehow related. Had Pollock encountered Kate while on patrol? Had they possibly met at a bar when Kate was in town? Was it even credible that a sophisticated British executive would fall for a game warden? The thought made Joe shake his head. Did Pollock have a dark side that might have led him to grab Kate as she left the ranch? Could his guilt about the incident have led him to flee his job? The door itself was made of cheap laminated wood with a four-pane window in the center of it. He thought about knocking out one of the glass panes so he could reach inside and unlock it. He decided instead to simply shoulder his way in. Joe glanced around again to make sure no one was watching, then threw himself toward the left side of the door. The door jamb splintered free on the inside, and he stepped quickly inside and shut it. There were tools and a workbench and a pile of scrap wood in the corner of the garage. He knew he could remount the lock plate and fix his damage before he left. Pollock's pickup truck was open, and the keys were in the center console. Joe climbed inside and looked around. The Ford F-150 was a newer model than the one he drove, and it was remarkably neat and clean inside. Even the floor mats were clean. This is the kind of vehicle you get, Joe thought, when you don't have the dubious reputation of destroying more state vehicles than any other employee. He dug around and found Pollock's citation book in a seat pocket and thumbed through it. Pollock had issued his last ticket 2 weeks before to a couple of ice fishermen on Saratoga Lake for fishing without licenses. There were no major incidents or arrests for the past 3 months that caught Joe's attention. What he was looking for was the type of violations that might result in bad blood between a game warden and a violator, something serious enough that Pollock had felt threatened by sticking around. But he found only standard stuff. Hunting in the wrong area, taking a doe pronghorn antelope in a buck-only area, failing to adequately tag elk. The book contained citations going back 18 months. Joe recognized none of the names of the perpetrators, but made a list of them in his own notebook. He replaced the citation book in the seat pocket where he'd found it. There were flex cuffs in the glove box, as well as a package of jerky, an unopened can of Copenhagen chewing tobacco, and a field first aid kit. But as he went through the truck, Joe became more and more puzzled, not by what he found, but by what he didn't find. He climbed out and opened the utility box in the bed of the truck and looked inside. There were extra coats and vests, a sleeping bag, ropes, chains, come-alongs, a shovel, winter overalls, and extra Sorel pack boots, a handyman jack, road flares, as well as gloves, ice creepers, and a satellite phone. But no briefcase that might have contained paperwork, maps, and other items. Game wardens lived in their vehicles. Their pickups were not only their means of transportation, but they also served as their offices in the field and holding cells when necessary. Every nook and cranny of Joe's truck was used to store or cram something. There were topo maps wedged between the bench seats, evidence bags including tooth envelopes for determining the age of carcasses, ballistics pamphlets, seizure tags, a necropsy kit, and reams of printed departmental memos, edicts, and reports. Every warden pickup Joe had ever ridden in was in the same condition, and many were much worse when it came to clutter. Either Steve Pollack was the neatest and tidiest game warden in the state of Wyoming, Joe thought, or someone had already been through his truck and removed most of the contents. Whether that was Pollack himself or someone else was the question Joe couldn't answer. The door into the house from the garage was unlocked, so Joe didn't have to force it open. It also meant that Pollack probably entered his house primarily through that door. Pull into the garage, shut the garage door, and go inside. It was a good procedure for a game warden, Joe knew. Saratoga, like Saddle String, was a hunting and fishing community. Locals kept close track of where the game warden patrolled, especially potential violators. If the game and fish vehicle was parked at home out front, it served as a green light to poach or commit other crimes. But if the vehicle couldn't be seen from the street, if it were parked in the garage, it meant the game warden could be anywhere. The door opened onto a small vestibule that served as a mudroom. Boots lined the floor, hats and caps were lined cheek by jowl on a high shelf, and over a dozen coats and parkas hung in between. Joe spent a few minutes going through the pockets of the coats and found nothing of interest except a few spent cartridge casings, gum, and empty Copenhagen tins. It was cold inside. Joe walked through the kitchen and found the thermostat mounted on a hallway wall. He turned it up to 68 and heard the sound of electric baseboards hum to life. He was grateful the department had continued to pay the electrical bill, even though the occupant was gone. The kitchen had the look of one used by a single man. Pollack had been divorced for a while, and apparently he'd had no partner at the time he vanished. There was one plate in the sink and one set of silverware. One glass had been turned upside down on a folded towel next to the sink. There were still items in the refrigerator. When Joe opened the door, he caught a whiff of spoiled milk. The freezer compartment was crammed full of locally packaged elk steak and burger. As he'd guessed the day before, it appeared that Pollack had simply walked out of the house. There were still clothes, including uniform shirts, in the bedroom closet. A suit hung still sheathed in clear plastic from a dry cleaning shop in Rawlins. Two of the dresser drawers were empty. He'd taken his underwear. Joe pushed the clothes aside to check out the corners of the closet, then he did the same in the two other bedrooms. He looked for Pollack's agency-issued weapons, an M14 carbine chambered in .308, a .40 Glock like the one Joe had on his hip, a .22 revolver loaded with cracker shells to scare off game animals, a scoped .270 rifle, and a Remington 12-gauge shotgun that held 7 rounds. He got down on his hands and knees and looked under the bed and found only dust bunnies. There were no weapons. Joe found it curious. If Pollack had taken the weapons, he'd committed the crime of stealing state property. Guns of every kind were easily available to anyone in Wyoming who wanted to buy them. It made no sense to Joe that Pollack would take that risk. As Joe grunted to his feet, his phone vibrated. It was Mary Beth. "What are you up to?" she asked. "I'd rather not say right now." She knew better than to ask by his tone, so she changed the subject. "You called this morning?" "Yep." He told her about the missing file and Nate's arrival after they'd talked the night before.
"So how is Nate?" she asked.
"He's Nate," Joe answered.
"And we wouldn't have it any other way, would we?" she said with a laugh.
He asked her to find out what she could about Richard Cheatham, and she agreed to do that.
"Anything on Kate?" he asked.
"I'm still looking," she said. "She had a Facebook page and was on Twitter, but she was very cautious. She only seemed to post things that were related to her clients and her company. No personal stuff at all. And of course, there's been no activity since July."
Pollock had used a spare bedroom as his home office, and Joe sat down behind the desk. When he jostled the mouse, the monitor of Pollock's computer came to life. The screensaver was a photo of Pollock digging his pickup out of the mud and glancing toward the photographer with a frustrated look on his face. Joe smiled. One of the features of the annual Wyoming Game Warden Foundation dinner was photos taken over the previous year of game wardens digging their pickups out of mud, rivers, and snowdrifts. It was the kind of gallows humor they all seemed to identify with and hoot at. Joe himself had been in several of the photos over the years, once when he'd broken an axle on a rock. But he couldn't get into Pollock's hard drive because he didn't know the password. He tried password as well as GF-18, Pollock's warden designation. Neither worked. Joe looked around on the desktop and in the drawers for a hidden sticky note that might reveal the password. He found nothing. He'd have to wait for a department investigator to officially enter the home and send the computer to the crime lab. That could take weeks or months, but he had no choice other than to leave it be. If he took the computer with him now, it would be an admission of breaking and entering the house. Frustrated, Joe opened Pollock's file drawer on the side of the desk. Pollock was neat and organized, and the files were hung alphabetically inside. Behind the A tab were manila file folders with headers including Antelope licenses, Antelope numbers, Antelope harvest, and so on. Behind the C tab were Pollock's old citation books that went beyond the one Joe had found in the truck. D was for deer, and E was for endangered species. The records were voluminous, and Joe spent nearly an hour thumbing through the tabs for anything out of the ordinary, which he didn't find. He checked his watch. On the way to Pollock's, he'd called Mark Gordon, the general manager of the Silver Creek Ranch. Gordon had agreed to meet with him, but said he had to do it at 1 o'clock before he drove to Denver for a flight. He sounded like a very busy man. Joe pushed back in the office chair and stood up. The heat had been on since he adjusted it, but he could still see his breath. He wondered what he was missing, and if he should consider coming back when he had more time. As he turned for the door, he stopped. Again, it wasn't what he had found, but what he hadn't found. He walked back to the file drawer and double-checked. There was no file for the Silver Creek Ranch under S, and not a single folder mentioned Kate Shelford Longdon. It seemed to Joe that a man as fastidious as Pollock would have kept records on the premier dude ranch in the area that included vast hunting and fishing opportunities, as well as a bizarre missing persons case that had occurred within his own district. But the files didn't exist. Then he realized that the entire B section was missing as well. The only explanation Joe had was that whomever had cleared out Pollock's pickup had also gone through his files and removed some of them. Had Pollock taken them along with his weapons? But which ones? And why? Joe was a little embarrassed by the poor patch job he did on the inside of the back garage door, but he was pressed for time.
He'd resorted to securing the lock plate back into the jamb using a couple of lengths of lathe, and he'd screwed them in using Pollock's electric screwdriver from his workbench. He stepped outside and closed the door. He put a little pressure on it to make sure it held, and he was pleased with the result. As he climbed into his pickup and backed out through the drift, he glanced through his side window at the road, just in time to see a light-colored pickup with a camper shell pulling away from the curb and driving toward downtown. He didn't recall seeing it when he'd arrived at Pollock's. Part 3. We are chameleons, and our partialities and prejudices change place with an easy and blessed facility, and we are soon wonted to the change and happy in it. Mark Twain. Chapter 15. I've already talked to law enforcement several times about all of this, Silver Creek Ranch General Manager Mark Gordon said to Joe from behind his desk. He appeared to be trying not to show his impatience with Joe's arrival. Don't get me wrong, I'd like to find out what happened to Kate as much as anyone on earth, maybe more. This thing has been hanging over our heads for months, and I'd really like to see it get resolved. Gordon's office was surprisingly small for such a massive operation, Joe thought. It was located adjacent to a receptionist desk in the administration structure. The latter was a renovated log cabin that from the outside looked like it had been constructed for a single man in the 1950s. The office cabin was on a hillside tucked away in a copse of fat, bell-shaped spruce and could barely be seen from the ranch complex itself, which was both vast and understated at the same time. Within the sprawling complex below was a massive lodge, the activity center, barns and outbuildings, an indoor shooting range, a saloon, the largest indoor riding arena Joe had ever seen, and dozens of well-appointed cabins for guests. Although most of the buildings had been built in recent years, they'd been constructed to blend into the folds and contours of the exposed granite boulders of the terrain, like natural outgrowths of the landscape itself. Even under 18 inches of snow, the Silver Creek Ranch at first sight took his breath away. Gordon was large, fit, and anxious. His dark hair was pasted back, and he had a fashionable 3-day growth of salt and pepper whiskers framing a thick reddish mustache. He had intense hazel eyes, and a habit of drumming the eraser end of a pencil at the top of his desk while he talked, and thumping it hard on the wood to emphasize a point. He wore a fleece vest over a button-down shirt with SCR embroidered on the breast. His manner indicated that he had a lot to do and not enough time to do it, even though it was January and there were no guests at the facility. This winter has been absolutely brutal, Gordon said to Joe. We've got a 5-month season and 7 months to update, maintain, and improve the ranch. 3 of those months have been like this. He indicated the heavy snow outside his window. The clock is ticking, he said. A huge whiteboard covered the wall inside his office, and a long list of projects to be completed was written on it in colored scrawls. Renovate Bridger, Owens, Saddlehorn units. Complete ropes course. Test all 32 wells. Update four-wheeler fleet. Wind turbine project. Order wine for cellar. 3,000 pheasants for upland game bird farm. And on. And on. I realize you've gone over much of this ground before, Joe said. I really don't want to waste your time, but it would be helpful to me if you gave me some background on the ranch as it pertains to Kate. The governor has asked me to look into this case while I'm here. Governor Allen? Gordon asked, suspicious. Yep.
I've already talked to his chief of staff. Hanlon was his name, I think. He called to ask if there had been any developments. Joe tried not to show his surprise. Hanlon hadn't told Joe that he'd talked to Gordon directly. Once again, the governor's office had come up in a circumstance that seemed odd.
When was that?
Joe asked. Oh, I think it was a month ago. He also wanted me to invite our owners to the governor's antelope hunt next fall as his guests.
Ah.
Joe knew that this year the invitation had been made only to Allen's biggest political contributors. Allen's predecessor, Governor Rulon, had invited ordinary Wyoming citizens.
It said something about both of them, Joe thought.
So can you give me some background on the ranch, even though you've done it before?
Joe asked.
Gordon glanced at his wristwatch, then said,
This ranch is like no other property I've ever managed, and that includes the 35 hotels and resorts I've opened up around the world. This place has special challenges, and every day is a new adventure. Last week, the pipes froze and burst in the main lodge, and we're trying to find master plumbers to come in and fix them. There are so many existential factors working against us here. We've got the weather, the distance from a major airport, and the lack of a nearby population center to draw contractors and employees. Not to mention that creating a super luxury resort in the least populated state in the country brings its own challenges.
Not that I'm complaining, Gordon said.
I wouldn't trade it for anything else in the hospitality industry. My owners have put hundreds of millions of dollars into this property to make it the best in the world, and it is. It's a privilege to make this place hum. We've reached out to the entire world to tell them about us, and we've been rewarded by nearly 100% occupancy. Our market isn't the 1%.
Gordon said.
It's 1% of the 1%. Those people who can choose to holiday anywhere in the world. Convincing them to come out here to the Wild West and get dusty may sound to some like a crazy idea, but we did our research.
While Gordon talked, Joe scribbled in his pad and nodded to encourage him to keep going.
We hire over 200 employees to serve 90 guests, the GM said. That's an astounding level of service. Our guests include household names in entertainment, politics, and business. We've hosted the president's son-in-law.
He went on to fire off a laundry list of celebrity names. Even Joe had heard of a few of them. He knew his daughter Lucy would know them all and be impressed. Sheridan had let a few names slip in phone calls with her mother.
They come from around the world for a 7-day ranch experience like no other, Gordon said. These are people who are used to being treated like kings and queens, and they come here to be cowboys and cowgirls for a week. Our research showed that in the back of many men's minds is the desire to be a cowboy, and that many women want to play cowgirl as long as they can retire to a luxury cabin at night and enjoy the finest food and wine available anywhere. Once they know that, he continued, we're in contact with our guests at least 6 times from their first inquiry to when they show up. We know as much as we possibly can about every guest in order to make this the best vacation they've ever had in their lives.
Joe recalled the questionnaire he'd seen of Kate's.
Why a week minimum? Gordon asked before answering his own question. Because it takes a full 3 days to get our guests to unplug and disengage from their phones and the rest of their busy lives. You can actually watch their protective armor melt away on day 3. Then they become real people, which is why they came here in the first place. There are no categories of guests, no special status for anyone. They're all our guests, and they're all treated with courtesy and respect equally, whether they're celebrities or newlyweds on a once-in-a-lifetime honeymoon. Our staff sign non-disclosure agreements promising not to publicize our client list on social media and not to talk about them in town. That guarantees privacy. Our guests really appreciate that.
You know, Gordon said, we do a lot of good in this valley.
Joe looked up for more.
We're one of the biggest employers in the county.
We contribute hundreds of thousands of dollars to the community and endow even more to ensure top-tier medical facilities. Every year we host inner-city kids to experience nature for the first time.
So, Gordon said, thumping his pencil on the desktop like the tail of an excited puppy,
this is why it's so disconcerting to have a guest just vanish, and for that incident to become a news story in our biggest overseas market. So if you can help solve this thing, we'll be eternally grateful, and you can bet we'll show our appreciation to Governor Allen.
250 employees are a lot to keep track of, Joe said. How are they vetted?
Thoroughly, Gordon said. More thoroughly than any other resort I've ever worked at. Every one of them has to have character references before they go through two background checks. If they sail through, there's fairly intense hospitality training. We get the best of the best.
Like your daughter, Sheridan.
Joe blushed with pride but kept to the task at hand.
Not that there is never any drama,
Gordon said with a bemused grin.
You can't take 200 single 20-somethings from around the country and put them into one place and not have some drama. June is the first round of employee romance, and it's inevitable. Many of the breakups occur the 1st of July. Some go on. Our human resources department calls that period as the wagon wheel turns.
Joe smiled, thought of Sheridan and Lance Ramsey, and frowned. Joe said, no one who's looked into this case before me has suspected any of the staff.
And neither do we, Gordon said. We did our own internal investigation as well.
Joe looked up. What did you conclude?
We concluded that something happened to Kate after she left the ranch, and that whatever happened to her had no connection to her week here. This isn't like a normal company where the employees show up and do their shift and go home, Gordon said. It's like one huge extended family during the season. Our people stay together here in one place. They work hard together, and they're with each other 24/7. Nothing that happens in one corner of the ranch isn't known by everybody else that night. There are no secrets, is what I'm saying. If one of our staff had something inappropriate going on with Kate, we all would have known about it.
Look, Gordon said, leaning forward at his desk and lowering his voice.
I'll give you a glimpse into how we operate, so you'll know why it doesn't make sense to suspect anyone here.
Okay. He continued.
Unlike the vast majority of resorts, we encourage our people to interact with the guests and treat them like normal people. Our guests are a little surprised at that the first 3 days, and then they understand the purpose of that is to set them all at ease. And that happens 95% of the time. Our guests enjoy our staff and sometimes invite them to dinner with them, or even extend an invitation to visit in the off-season. We don't discourage that, but we absolutely draw the line at any kind of fraternizing, like between a guest and his or her wrangler or fishing guide.
So it's never happened? Joe asked.
Most of our wranglers are beautiful girls, Gordon said, your daughter included. I see how one could assume that male guests might proposition them. I see that. But our wranglers are a tight-knit group, and they look out for one another. They go to church together. They just don't entertain that sort of thing.
So it's never happened?
Joe asked again.
It's extremely rare, Gordon said. And if it does, that staff member is immediately dismissed. That's only happened one or two times in the whole time I've been here. We've let go a housekeeper and a fishing guide.
And nothing like that happened between an employee and Kate?
Absolutely not,
he said, thumping his pencil so hard it popped out of his grip and he had to retrieve it.
Every morning during the season, we have a daily stand-up.
Joe scribbled daily stand-up in his notebook and Gordon picked up on it.
While our guests are at breakfast, all of our departments get together for a briefing,
Gordon explained.
They talk about what's on the schedule for the day, but they also talk candidly about guest satisfaction. They play psychologists to unlock the desires of every guest, so when our customers leave this place, they're raving about it. But they also discuss problem guests. There are a few here and there, and how to deal with them. If Kate were creating any issues, we would have known about it and addressed it. But our investigation found that Kate was very popular among the staff.
Our head wrangler, Lance Ramsey, spent the most time with her, and he said she'd fallen head over heels for the place, especially riding.
Joe asked, "Is it unusual for a single woman to book a week here?" Gordon nodded.
"It's not the norm, but we get a few every year. Most of our guests are families."
"Anything odd take place with the other singles?"
"Of course not. They all returned home safely."
He said it definitively, but Joe noted a flutter of his eyelids as he said it. It was a tell.
Joe waited a moment for Gordon to continue, but he didn't finish whatever thought had entered his mind. So Joe prompted him. "Are there any similarities in personality or circumstances with the single guests? I ask this because you guys obviously know a lot about your customers."
"Well,"
Gordon said as his neck flushed slightly,
"we do, and there are."
As he said it, the GM slid his chair back and opened a file drawer on the right side of his desk. He withdrew a folder and placed it on his desk.
"They're all British women," Gordon said, not quite meeting Joe's eyes. "All successful British women, many professionals, like Kate. Some married, some not."
Joe raised his eyebrows with interest.
"This is how we market our property," Gordon said.
He slid a Silver Creek Ranch tourism brochure across the surface of the desk to Joe, who picked it up. It was printed on heavy paper, and as he thumbed through it, he was impressed by the high quality of the scenic photography. There were deep orange western sunsets, big skies, guests on horseback or fly fishing. He'd seen many of the images on the SCR website, and in the missing case file before, but he was struck by how atmospheric and well done the photos were.
"This is how our exclusive tour operators in the UK market the property," Gordon said, withdrawing two glossy brochures from the file.
Rather than a sunset or horseback ride, the cover of the first brochure from a tour operator called Western Dreams was a dusky photo of cowboys lined up on a fence with their backs to the camera. Joe recognized that they were watching a rodeo rider inside the arena, but the rider himself wasn't shown. What was shown, in sharp detail, were 11 backsides in tight Wrangler jeans. He thumbed through the brochure to see more of the same. Rugged young wranglers on horseback, cowboys adjusting the flank straps on saddles while older women looked on, a stoic horseman leading a herd of horses toward the camera.
"Different approach," Joe said.
Gordon had a slightly embarrassed grin. He said,
Certain British women come over here for a different reason than our American family guests. Our UK tour operators have figured that out, and they market directly to them. It seems some British women really want to be around young cowboys.
Joe had some familiarity with the phenomenon. It wasn't unknown among the dude and guest ranches in the Bighorn Mountains near his base. In fact, he'd once been in the Stockman's Bar in Saddle String on Wednesday night, the night a local dude ranch sent its guests to town as part of their weekly activity schedule. He'd witnessed a lone woman dude ranch guest in her 50s. In fact, she was British. Seduce a young local cowboy with multiple Coors Lights and shots of Jim Beam, and then leave the bar with him. Joe had been struck by how young the ranch hand was and how predatory the woman. And Joe had once encountered two faux cowboys from the east who dressed up in Western wear solely to attract older women dude ranch guests and later fleece them.
It's simply a market niche, Gordon said somewhat defensively. Different markets have different niches. We provide the same experience to all of our guests, and we don't cater to anything untoward. But it is what it is.
Was Kate on the prowl, then? Joe asked.
We have no information at all that she was. We would have known. You're welcome to talk to Lance or Sheridan, in fact. They spent the most time with Kate while she was here.
Was Kate disappointed by all the female wranglers?
Gordon huffed a laugh. Not that she indicated. We ask all of our guests to complete a thorough exit survey on their last day while the experience on the ranch is fresh in their mind. I'll give you a copy of her exit survey as I did with the other investigators if you'd like. You can believe me when I tell you Kate didn't even mention the gender of the wranglers. Her only comment was that they were all excellent.
Joe asked, Have you met Kate's sister Sophie and Billy Bloodworth? Gordon's face twitched involuntarily. Another tell.
Unfortunately, I have, Gordon said. They came out here a few days ago, and one of my maintenance guys pulled their vehicle out of a snowdrift. They were snooping around, but they didn't want to admit it, I guess. I told Sophie how sorry we all were about her sister. She seems like a sincere person. That Bloodworth guy, though.
What about him?
Gordon sat back and crossed his arms across his chest. He kept pumping me for the names of famous people who'd stayed here. He was very persistent and even rude, but I didn't give him a single name. Even when he listed some of our actual guests, I wouldn't confirm the names. I thought he was a pain in the ass looking for some kind of sensational angle for his cheap tabloid.
Did they mention they might have a suspect?
Joe asked, recalling the photo on Sophie's phone the night before. No, but Bloodworth acted like he blamed me and this ranch for Kate's disappearance, Gordon said, as if this place had lured her here to be kidnapped. He kept calling the ranch posh, as if there was something wrong with that. I think it was more about his own class anxieties, if you want my personal opinion. He adopted an English accent and said,
What kind of people can afford a posh place like this when the homeless are starving?
Questions like that.
What did you tell him?
I threw them the hell out of here, Gordon said. I don't have time for that. And I called our security guys and asked them to escort them off the property so they wouldn't take any more photos of the buildings.
Ah, said Joe. Gordon glanced at his wristwatch again.
Anything else, Mr. Pickett?
Joe read through his notes. He could tell that Gordon wanted to move on. On Kate's registration, she was marked as an FIT. What's that mean?
It's travel industry terminology for foreign individual traveler, Gordon said. It means she booked direct through our tour operator. It means she didn't come as part of a group.
Thank you.
What's glamping?
Glamorous camping, the GM said. Guests stay in tents or teepees, but with all the comforts of our lodge as well as great food.
When Joe looked up puzzled, Gordon shrugged and said,
It's a thing.
Joe nodded toward the whiteboard. What's the wind turbine project?
We were approached by representatives from Buckbrush about constructing 50 turbines on the property. They tried to sell it to us as a way of making the resort green, which they claimed would attract socially conscious guests. They might have a point, but we weighed that against spoiling the view shed with those monstrosities and decided against it. Not that they've given up on it, though. There had been reports about Buckbrush vehicles sneaking around this winter.
Interesting, Joe said. Then, which employee is SP2?
Sheridan Pickett, Gordon said with a rare smile. I believe you know her.
Steve Pringle is our head chef, so he's SP1. Contractors, Joe said. How are they vetted?
Unless they're directly involved with an activity here like a celebrity wedding, they aren't, Gordon said with hesitation. We simply can't do background checks on every vendor or contractor we work with. Think about it. We're talking food suppliers, mechanics, construction companies, and all the specialty people associated with the operations of a large-scale ranch. It would be a daunting challenge. But understand that contractors have little or no interaction with guests.
The DCI agent you spoke to listed two particular contractors for follow-up interviews, Joe said, as he found the names in his notebook. He thought I should talk to Ben and Brady Youngberg, as well as Jack and Joshua Tubner.
Our farriers and our fish hatchery guys, Gordon nodded. I can see why they're worth talking to. I don't know a lot about either of them myself, but their names came up when we did our internal investigation. We didn't interview them ourselves.
I met the Youngbergs last night, Joe said. Things almost got Western.
Gordon squinted at Joe, not comprehending. Joe moved on.
Could I get a complete list of your outside contractors?
Gordon sighed and said,
Sure. I had a list compiled a couple of months ago. I've handed it over to Sheriff Neal and your DCI. Like I said, I've answered all of these questions before.
The GM pushed back and left his office to ask the receptionist to print off the list, as well as to make another copy of Kate's exit survey. While he did, Joe slipped his cell phone out of his uniform breast pocket and took several shots around the room, particularly the tasks listed on the whiteboard. He didn't suspect Gordon of withholding anything, but he wanted to be thorough. On the front porch of the administration cabin, Gordon swept his arm to take in the enormity of the Silver Creek Ranch below, while Joe clamped on his Stetson.
You should see it in the summer, he said. It's a magnificent place.
It looks pretty good right now.
Are you going to see your daughter while you're here?
Yep.
You'll find her at the arena, Gordon said. She's a good one. You and your wife should be proud.
We are.
I wish we had 100 more like her, Gordon said.
Then, I'm sorry, but I really gotta get going to Denver to catch my plane. With that, he mounted a 4-wheel ATV and roared through the snow to the employee parking lot. Joe wanted to find Sheridan. He also hoped Lance Ramsey would be there. But he had the nagging feeling that he was covering the same ground that Sheriff Neal and DCI Agent Williams had already trod. Except for his missing file and the glimpse he'd had of the photo on Sophie's phone, it seemed like he was getting nowhere fast. At the same time, he couldn't get rid of the thought that he was missing something in plain sight. If only he could figure out what it was.
Chapter 16.
For Nate Romanowski, the Tubner Fish Hatchery was the second strange sight he'd taken in after leaving Saratoga that morning. And as odd and incongruous as it was, a fish hatchery located in the middle of nowhere, it didn't even compare to the first. After driving north from Saratoga that morning after breakfast with Joe, he'd left the ice-covered state highway for the more familiar feel of an improved gravel road that ran straight and true east through a vast sagebrush-covered plain directly toward the snowy range in the distance. Although Nate drove his four-wheel drive GMC Yukon XL, he found that the drifts across the road had been plowed that morning and it was clean and clear. Someone, not the county for sure, had spent a lot of money constructing such a wide and heavy-duty road, he thought. But it wasn't the mountains that dominated the horizon. It was hundreds of white wind turbines, their blades rotating against the deep blue sky, as if propelling the scudding clouds along and out of their way. The turbines were so high and massive that it took twice as long as he thought it would to arrive at the Buckbrush Wind Energy Project. As he got closer, Nate was stunned by the scale of it. Towers in different stages of construction stretched as far as he could see, with improved roads connecting each concrete base. He was reminded of an epic prairie dog town, but upside down. Many of the turbines were already operational, and he'd never seen so many in one place. But it wasn't the number of functional turbines that stunned him. It was the fact that the project looked only about 10% complete. Vehicles and machinery moved over the network of roads, taking parts of the wind turbines from one place to another for assembly. A single blade on the trailer of a flatbed tractor trailer dwarfed the vehicle itself. He'd read about the project, but it had been hard to comprehend without seeing it with his own eyes. The largest wind energy facility in the world. 1,250-foot turbines placed within the largest footprint of land, 2,000 acres, ever designated for a wind farm. Situated on land with consistent Class 6 and 7 winds. Each turbine is designed to produce 3 megawatts of electricity. The electricity produced is a result not of market forces, but a combination of federal tax incentives and mandates imposed by state and local governments. The mandates were that a significant portion of their power come from renewable sources, including solar and wind, even though it's more expensive than traditional methods of electricity generation. Once complete, the project will power 1 million homes in California via transmission lines. Also, on the plus side, are the hundreds of high-paying construction jobs the facility produced in a county where the coal mines have been shuttered. Nate stayed on the road and saw that a half mile ahead, it was blocked by a high chain-link gate. He noticed how the air pressure within the Yukon changed the closer he got to the working turbines. It seemed to push down on his head and shoulders. There was also a steady low hum from the spinning blades that replaced the sound of the wind through the sagebrush. It was a kind of subsonic whooshing that made Nate's stomach clench. He braked to a stop at the gate in front of a sign directing him to do so. On the other side of the fence was a single wide trailer, and a figure emerged from it zipping up a heavy parka and pulling a hood up and over his head. He moved in a jerky way that conveyed he was annoyed by the intrusion. The man swiped a keycard across a unit mounted on the fence, and a walkway gate opened. Nate couldn't see the man's face because his head was covered by the hood. Embroidered on the breast of the parka was Buckbrush Security. The security guard circled the Yukon and noted Nate's license plate number on a clipboard before coming up to the driver's side window. He stood there until Nate powered it down.
This is private property and you're not on my vendor list. Do you have business here? The man asked. The hood was long and conical, and all Nate could see of his face were yellow teeth framed by dark, rubbery lips. And what the hell is Yerrick Inc.?
I run a commercial falconry operation,
Nate said. Where are your falcons?
At my headquarters. I don't drive around with them inside.
Falcons, huh?
Yeah, the kind these turbines chop up.
The security guard said, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Right.
If you've got a grievance, you can file it with the bosses.
I don't have a grievance, but I'm sure I could find one,
Nate said. Then what are you doing here?
Nate peered down the length of the high fence to his right and then to his left. It was so long it literally vanished from sight in both directions.
I'm trying to get to the Tubner fish hatchery. My map said it's dead ahead, but...
So you're a falconer without falcons looking for a fish hatchery in the middle of the winter,
the guard said with sarcasm.
Exactly.
This used to be the road to get there, but this is as far as you can go now. You've got an old map, the security guard said.
He vaguely gestured to the north.
You'll have to go around.
How far is that?
Nate asked. Although the parka was bulky, it didn't hide the shrug.
Not my problem, the guard said, starting to turn back to his trailer.
Thanks for all your help, Nate called after him. Those people in California should feel good that a man with your social skills is helping them keep their lights on and their air conditioners running so they don't even have to think about where their power comes from.
The guard stopped and turned. The tube of his hood pointed at Nate like a gun muzzle.
What the hell is that supposed to mean? He asked.
Nate powered his window up and backed away. He'd seen what he wanted to see, and it confirmed his worst fears. Anger coursed through him, and he found himself gripping the wheel so tightly he couldn't feel his fingers. The security guard, and Joe, for that matter, didn't have any idea that an important piece of Nate's conspiracy theory had just snapped into place. It took 2 hours to circumnavigate the Buckbrush Project on a service road that paralleled the chain-link fence in order to find a road that took him east again. As he drove, he glanced out the side window to get different perspectives on Buckbrush. The westbound transmission lines were strung from structure to structure until they merged with the horizon and vanished out of sight. The late afternoon winter sun reflected on the lines, and they looked like frozen steel ocean waves lapping toward California. He couldn't recall ever seeing such a sprawling man-made facility, and it made him feel small. Nate relished feeling small in nature. He despised feeling small next to 1,000 windmills. If he were king, he thought, he would require every California politician who mandated green energy as well as every resident who would be the recipient of the electricity produced at Buckbrush to come see the massive complex where their power actually came from. He'd make them walk the steel perimeter and look inside the fence at what they'd built on top of a wild game migration corridor. And he wouldn't allow them earplugs to protect them from the punishing whoosh. It was a good thing, he decided, that he wasn't king. The Tubner fish hatchery was located in a most unlikely location, Nate thought. Rather than being situated near a river or stream, the cluster of long metal ramshackle structures rose out of a sagebrush and snow-choked bench 14 miles from the nearest paved road. There wasn't even a tree on the property. The cluster of buildings looked as if they'd been assembled over several decades. In addition to the long metal buildings was a 2-story home, a huge metal barn filled with vehicles and what looked like an outhouse. He slowed to a stop on the two-track road and consulted the topo map on the passenger seat to confirm it was the correct location after all. Having to go around Buckbrush to get to the hatchery had thrown off his bearings. Snow-capped Elk Mountain rose from the plains in the background and dominated the eastern skyline. High-altitude wind picked up loose snow on top and carried it away so it looked like there was a thin flag unfurling from the summit. The ever-present wind had also cleared much of the snow from the two-track roads on the bench that led to the hatchery, although he'd had to gun his four-wheel drive GMC Yukon through several drifts that blocked the road. Fish hatchery owners didn't take care of their roads like Buckbrush did. As he neared the hatchery, he saw a man exit one of the buildings and stride toward another. The man leaned against the wind and walked quickly to get out of it. He froze when he saw Nate's Yukon coming up the road. Then he broke into a run and disappeared into the longest metal building as if Nate's arrival had spooked him. It was the behavior of someone guilty of something, which was odd. Nate felt a rush of adrenaline. His senses sharpened, and he locked in on the five ramshackle buildings like a falcon at 2,000 feet, locking in on an earthbound rabbit. Was Kate confined in one of them? He kept in mind Joe's admonition not to bust any heads and to back off if things got hinky. Nate thought, "The hell with that." He cruised slowly into the hatchery yard toward the house. He noted that the barn was filled with trucks mounted with round plastic tanks behind the cabs. He assumed the tanks were filled with water and hatchery fish to be delivered to private ponds and lakes. It was obvious none of the vehicles had been used for a while, though, because there was a knife-like snowdrift across the front of the open building that hadn't been breached. A hand-painted sign on the side of the front door of the house read, "Tubner Fish Hatchery, Office. Ring Bell." Nate climbed out of the Yukon and zipped up his heavy coat against the wind and to conceal his weapon. The wind blew hard, and it was filled with tiny ice crystals that stung his face. This location, he thought, made more sense for a wind farm than a fish hatchery. He pushed on the bell, waited, and pushed it again. When there was no response, he reached down and found the door unlocked. Inside was a large room cluttered with plastic tubs and coffin-sized concrete tanks. Water burbled, and the smell was dank and earthy. Fish food. "Hello?" His voice echoed through the room. Nate walked among the tanks and looked down inside. Thousands of tiny slivers moved away from him, as if they were a single organism.
"Can I help you?"
Nate turned and involuntarily reached up for the tab of his zipper in case he needed to get to his gun. A squat man in his late 50s or early 60s stood up from a desk in a small office in the back corner of the room. He wore stained coveralls and knee-high rubber boots. His head was large, and he had jowls that trembled when he talked.
"I rang the bell,"
Nate said.
"It don't work."
"I figured that."
"You the fish inspector?"
the man asked. He eyed him suspiciously. Nate paused. "Fish inspector."
"You're not the fish inspector, are you?"
the man said.
"Do I look like a fish inspector?"
"I don't know what you look like. Are you a fish buyer?"
"Let's say I was. What would you tell me?"
The man took a deep breath.
"I'm Jack Tubner. This is my place. We supply catchable trout to nearly 100 ponds and lakes across 5 states. Rainbows, browns, cutthroats, cutbows, and tigers. This is the incubation room. Are you looking to buy some?"
"Maybe,"
Nate said.
"But these are too small."
"They're fry,"
Tubner said. They'll be 2 to 3 inches long by the summer, and then we'll move them out to the raceways. In a year, they'll be big enough to stock. Meanwhile, we'll start the whole incubation process in here again. You can see it takes a while, so if you want to make an order, you need to do it soon. Like now. Otherwise, you'll be shit out of luck.
Nate nodded. Jack Tubner seemed oddly stiff and discouraging for a fish salesman.
Where do you get your water?
Nate asked.
Tubner tapped his foot on the concrete floor. You're standing on top of a natural spring. We built the hatchery right on top of it. The spring produces 2,500 gallons of water per minute. It's pure, too, not like the water that comes from lakes or the river, no particulates or bacteria. That's why our fish are so healthy.
Is this a 2-man operation?
Nate asked.
I saw someone outside when I drove up.
My son, Joshua, Jack said.
He ran, like he was scared of me.
He don't like fish inspectors any more than I do, Jack said. Either the state guys or the federal guys. Those idiots could shut me down in a minute if they thought they found something wrong, and I don't trust their methods. They take samples of our water and our fry, and I worry they'll get cross-contaminated with fish from some other place but blame me.
I'm not a fish inspector, Nate said.